Hello and welcome to the newest installment of Entertainment Weekly's Best of Shows, the podcast where we take a look at the best of television and the rest of television. Though right now it's all best all the time. This is another great entry in our mini-series treatment of the best shows of the 20-teens. Today we are talking best comedies. I am Darren Franich, TV critic at Entertainment Weekly, joined as always by my brilliant colleague, Kristen Baldwin. Only good shows today.
Only Kristen. Good shows.
Which only is, the finest shows, I would say.
The best of the decade.
And I don't know how you feel. This is our penultimate episode in this limited series event.
Yes.
Where we're focusing on best comedy. But as excited as I am next week to talk about best drama, for me, this decade, when I think about the shows that were really pushing the medium forward, when I think about the shows that when they were great, you know, week to week, or if they were bingeable, you know, the moment of the year when all the episodes came out, just the stuff that I was most excited about, I think more often than not, it was comedy, or it was, you know, it was the half hour mode of episodic television. Did you feel that this decade as kind of a shift from what we had in the 2000s?
You know, I have a hard time remembering what I wore yesterday, so I'm not going to pretend that I remember, you know, sort of the grander sense of what I needed out of TV in the 2000s. But I will tell you that I do definitely feel like in the last 5 years, especially, like, and even over the last decade, we've, you know, comedy has been more important than ever, just in terms of like, being able to cope with the world and, you know, the way comedy is able to comment on often, you know, the very painful things that are happening in our society. It's very cathartic. And as somebody who uses humor and sarcasm as a defense mechanism all the time, comedy is definitely my sort of language. Yes. What do they say? My love language. It's my love language.
Yes, yes, yes. Comedy as the sort of simultaneous force field and like the weapon for cutting through what was going on throughout this decade was very much forefront. And Kristen, that leads perfectly into the show that I'm going to talk about first. Well, we're not ranking them today.
No.
Everybody, you know, everyone should go online and, you know, check out our overall Best of the Decade list if what you're jonesing for are like the numbers. but I will just say my sort of personal pick for the best comedy of the 20-teens is the first show I'm talking about. That show is Atlanta, created by Donald Glover, debuted on FX in 2016. Only two seasons so far, and season two of this show, I would say, is essentially a perfect document of this decade. Atlanta is broadly a show about the rap industry in Atlanta, although it is very much about much more than that. Donald Glover plays Earn, who, when we meet him, is a basically broke everyman who becomes the manager for his cousin Alfred, played by the great Brian Tyree Henry, my favorite person on television this decade. Alfred is better known to the public as Paperboy.
Yeah.
He is a rapper, even though we never really ever get to hear him rap on the show, which is one of the many extremely surreal flourishes of this strange, the strange universe that Atlanta creates. In just a couple of seasons, the show's already made stars of the rest of its cast, including Lakeith Stanfield as Darius and Zazie Beetz as Van. And Kristen, for me, what I love about Atlanta is, you know, there's so much just to discuss with it, but more than anything, it's just such a great, visceral, vivid experience. Mm-hmm. Glover, of course, worked on a lot of other TV comedies, and I think he brings something kind of old-fashioned in the structure of the show. It's very much an episode show, and each individual episode, especially in season two, kind of comprises a journey the characters are on, and sometimes those journeys are so ludicrously straightforward. There's one episode that's all about the fact that Alfred really needs to get his hair cut, and that just becomes this incredible, you know, quest for Excalibur level series of unfortunate events that happen over the course of his day. But, you know, with that kind of old fashioned quality, there's just such a wonderful and vibrant sensibility. You know, one of the key collaborators on the show is the director Hiro Murai, who's also done some great work on another show that I think we're going to discuss today, Barry.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, what they've created did. Season one is so great, but season two, especially for me, that's just kind of the show of the decade, where every week it felt like there was a new masterpiece unfolding. And, you know, what it does with its comedic sensibility is just really remarkable. We've talked about this show plenty, Kristen, but how do you feel it kind of sits in the kind of comedies of the decade?
Well, I think it really represents, we talked a few weeks ago about sort of the auteur-created television that we've seen a lot of in this decade, and it really represents how that type of vision, especially in comedy or the half-hour format, can be more of, I love that you call it an experience, because it is, it's not a show that you watch and you just sort of watch passively. You know, it is as though you're there with these characters, and it does, you're not always, you know, it's not about all the LOLs. It's more just about looking at these people, these very clearly defined and very rich characters go through either relatable or completely bizarre experiences, like with the Black Justin Bieber episode. Right?
Oh my God. I mean, yeah, you know, you have stuff like that mixed together with one of my favorite episodes, especially in season two. It felt like it was really adopting the kind of character focus style of, which you're kind of more familiar with usually with dramas like Lost or The Leftovers. And there's an episode that's all about Van going out for New Year's at Drake's house.
Yes.
And like, you know, it's funny to me that gets at exactly what you're talking about, where on one hand, it is just sort of this incredible, almost experiential episode, and there's these like soliloquies, and it's just all very strange. At the same time, for pure LOLs, that episode is like chock full of them. And I love how the show kind of creates for me, there are just so many true belly laughs, even as, you know, what it's grappling with in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of, you know, for me, over the course of watching this show, I feel like I've kind of aged out of a lot of the stuff the characters are grappling with. Like in the Drake episode, that's kind of, to me, it's like a classic like going out episode where they're all talking about like Instagram and Snapchat, and you know, for me that's already kind of a foreign country, but I love how the show really kind of captures that so well. So I know I'm betting big on this. It's only been two seasons, and obviously, you know, with any show, you don't know what's going to happen with it. But for me, I just feel like when I think back on this decade, just for pure excitement terms, Atlanta is really kind of tops for me.
And I think that comedy like this, and you know, one of my shows coming up is also on FX, and I think that network has done a good job letting sort of comedies like this that aren't, you know, certainly they're not three camera comedies, but they're also just not traditional comedies, in that often they defy genre. They're sometimes funny, they're sometimes incredibly sad, they're sometimes just weird, but there's a lot that you can do in the half hour format that I think we've seen with these really sort of visionary creators, whether it's Donald Glover or, you know, Pamela Adlon or somebody like that, in the last decade. And, you know, that's certainly a benefit, or one of the, you know, good side effects of having so much goddamn TV, you know, is that we get, you know, that networks take chances, and
absolutely,
this is one of them. So
absolutely. Pamela Adlon, you say? Interesting.
Yes,
very interesting.
Yes. And I mean, I may as well just go right to her then. You know, back in 2016, FX announced that it was picking up a new series co-created by Louis C.K. and Pamela Adlon, and she was a writer, a working TV actor, and a voiceover actor. The show is called Better Things, and the press release described Better Things as a comedy that would star Pamela Adlon as, quote, a single working actor with three daughters as she navigates personal and professional situations. So, you know, that description may sound flat and even a little boring, but honestly, Better Things consistently delivered some of the most vivid and moving and deeply hilariously relatable comedy of the past decade. And just as an FYI, the show since 2017 has been under Pamela Adlon's full control after Louis C.K. was fired in 2017. So writer-director Adlon stars as Sam Fox, an LA-based actress and mother to three very different and very challenging children. There's her emotional oldest daughter, Max, played by Mikey Madison, brilliant and rebellious middle daughter, Frankie, played by Hannah Olligood, and youngest daughter, Duke, played by Olivia Edward. And Sam sort of resides in this long, unforgiving stretch of mid-middle age when the kids are still in the house and the grandparents, in this case her brusque and mentally fading mom, Phil, played by Celia Imrie, now need parenting themselves. And her day is an endless loop of cooking, driving, working, refereeing, and suffering, you know, through socializing with other parents, or the indignity of entering perimenopause, or the near constant wave of disdain that she receives from her children. At one point she says to them, "You like the part where I drive you and I pay for the things," which is clearly, clearly very much it. And you know, everything about Better Things feels very personal and yet somehow very vastly relatable to anyone who has ever loved a child, agonized over a difficult parent, endured an unsatisfying job, or wondered whether pushing their own personal rock up the hill yet again was really worth it. You know, it's such a hard show to describe. And when I tell people, like, you've just got to watch it, it's so good, you know, I just say, you know, often, I just say it's impossible to describe, but it's really, if it's very authentic, it's very funny, and you will find something to love about it. I mean, there, I just watched the scene in season 2, episode 2, again, where she breaks up with her boyfriend, and she's just not in, she's just not been that into him the whole time. And the breakup scene.
I love, that whole episode is great, but that scene is
this
incredible.
This scene is incredible because she just, she finally realizes that she's been dating him for 3 weeks, even though she's hated him since the moment she saw him. His face. And she says, "That's how nice I am." And then when he starts whining, she just starts saying to him, you know, "Jesus Christ, is she so high maintenance, this one?" You know, and just refers to him as a woman over and over again. And like, it's incredibly well done and very cathartic. And but then there are also just really beautiful scenes with her kids, or really frustratingly relatable scenes with her kids. It's just a show that is very clearly created by somebody who knows exactly what story she wants to tell, and it comes across.
Yeah, absolutely right. And Kristen, if I recall correctly, that episode you're talking about, which starts off with, to me, like, that is a very funny scene.
That is
also, I mean, in its own way, it's recognizable as a brilliant sitcom scene.
Yes.
I mean, it's very funny to see this sort of spiral of an argument that becomes just this massive breakup. And yet, from there, the episode just takes so many turns that are, you know, not what you expect ever moment to moment, but feel so earned. Because that's the episode, I think, that kind of ends with her on the beach having that maybe fantasy of hanging out with her kids. And to me, you know, Kristen, one kind of story of this decade in general was that, you know, you sort of had the breakdown of a lot of rules that defined television.
Mm-hmm.
And at times that could be frustrating. There are some shows where you watch them and you were kind of like, actually, these creators could have used some rules to follow. but this show is such the polar opposite, where, as you said, she knows exactly what kind of story she wants to tell. She is being able to kind of tell these individual episodes that always go in these directions you don't expect, but mm-hmm. that do always feel very controlled. And even the way that the three daughters, who are played by Mikey Madison, Hannah Allgood, and Olivia Edward, the way that they all seem to reflect different aspects of her personality is something that, I mean, it's easy to hear that, but to actually see it and to see how they perform it, it's just kind of fascinating. And, you know, to think about telling a personal story in a way that's so relatable, this show is definitely front and center in that regard. And it is kind of, what I like about it, too, is that it has found an audience. It is kind of ongoing, right?
Yeah.
They've already ordered season 4.
Yeah, and you can watch it now on Hulu, you know, past seasons, or FX Now, or eventually Hulu, FX on Hulu, when the giant conglomerate swallows the other one. It's it's an easy binge. And I just, you know, if you're not sure, if you're on the fence, just give it one episode, because it's so hard to do it justice talking about it, but it really is something special.
Atlanta, I should have said, is also on Hulu, which is also where you can watch the next show that I'm going to talk about. And I swear, this is not all going to be one big Donald Glover love fest, but it just so happens he was on one of my other favorite shows of the decade. I'm talking, of course, about Community, which debuted on NBC in late 2009, in fall 2009, but it's truly great years defined the start of the 2010s. Community is in its format, a kind of old-fashioned workplace friends hanging out sitcom set at Greendale Community College. It stars a true lineup of future all-stars of the decade, including Gillian Jacobs, Danny Putty, Vette Nicole Brown, Alison Brie, who wound up being on 4 great shows mm-hmm. this decade somehow, the aforementioned Donald Glover, Chevy Chase, and of course the star nominally when it started was Joel McHale. And Community, for me, Kristen, was the network sitcom that was simultaneously scratching every itch you'd want from a network mm-hmm. sitcom. This was a show that week in, week out was just telling really fun, quick, solid comedy plot lines. At the same time, famously, it was very meta. It was very conceptual. For me, the really best years would have been season 3 and season 5. And those were the years when creator Dan Harmon and his writers, just each week, you never knew what you were getting. They'd do these incredibly elaborate parody episodes. There were animated episodes. There was an episode that was just an incredibly spot on spoof of Law and Order that only made me appreciate Law and Order more. You know, this was a show that I think was near and dear to a lot of people's hearts. If you tend to think a lot about pop culture, it was so steeped in television history, so steeped in kind of the history of junky genre mm-hmm. everything. So as a result, I know it has a dear place in a lot of people's hearts. But for me, just it's a show that I like to revisit. There are so many kind of standouts and just the different registers of its comedy and the way that it could juggle really farcical out there stuff and even kind of outright fantasy. You know, the actors on the show were often called upon to play the other characters at times and feats of dream sequences and all that stuff. But more than anything, I think about the characters kind of at the table in the study yes. room and, you know, what could kind of happen there when you had all these incredibly defined personalities kind of sparking off each other. We talked about this a little bit in the finales episode, Kristen, yeah. but how do you kind of look back on community now and how it relates in general to what was really an awesome lineup of NBC sitcoms at that time?
I think, you know, NBC definitely gets credit for letting some weirdness happen in comedy that maybe some of the other networks did not. You know, that is a show, Community is never a show that I really got into. It's interesting. I think the more I talk about comedy with you, like, I enjoy either shows that are like really extreme in one way, or I want them to be very traditional. And so like the sort of the combination of the two leaves me, you know, a little befuddled. But
the dissonance, Kristen, it's the dissonance that makes it beautiful.
Yes. And, you know, I get that's why people love it. But I do think that NBC especially should get credit for, you know, letting something like that, or even Parks and Rec, which was a weird show, you know, or yeah. 30 Rock, definitely a really weird show in many ways. They certainly had built this comedy foundation, you know, in the 90s with Friends and Seinfeld and Cheers and all of that. But then in an attempt to recapture that glory going forward, they've let some really interesting things, especially for broadcast television, live. And I think this is definitely one of them. You know, it wasn't one that I ever really got into. I think I don't like Joel McHale.
Well, this is where I was going to say, Kristen, I'm glad you said that, because one of the things I like about this show so much is I don't want to say it was a full bait and switch, but it was definitely a show that when it started was a little bit more about, like, here's this sort of snarky guy, a very familiar archetype of, mm-hmm. of that time of comedy and of his generation. And just the way that very quickly over the course of the episodes, it became such a true ensemble. And even like the way that the Joel McHale type kind of became, in a very self-aware way, like a pastiche of himself. Yeah. There was so much richness there. And to me, that is kind of the defining thing with a great comedy is, like, you know, how quickly does it move from being about mm-hmm. one specific person to being about the ensemble or to being about how these characters kind of do interact with each other. But you're really right, Kristen. I mean, I try to be generally pretty forward-looking and optimistic about television and life. But I do feel at times like my lost TV utopia was, like, I think there was one half season where you had on NBC's Thursday all in one lineup, like Office, mm-hmm. Parks and Rec, 30 Rock, Community. And you know, that to me is just such a murderer's row of great talent yes. doing, as you said, this really eccentric comedy that nevertheless was intended to and very much could kind of play to the mainstream audience.
Right.
And so I think, yeah, like, Community was definitely the weirdest of the bunch, but that's probably why, you know, it holds such a special place for me in the comedies of this decade.
And it definitely paved the way for, like, some other, you know, like now when you look at a show like AP Bio, which was, you know, essentially saved, yeah. it does seem to be like it owes its existence to a show like Community.
Definitely.
And but yeah, so, and you, Community, where can you stream that right now?
Still currently on Hulu, Kristen, though from what I understand there may be a bidding war about it in the as the streaming wars continue to dig deeper into classic sitcoms.
All right, well, get it while you can. So the next comedy on my list almost didn't happen. Before HBO signed a deal with Armando Iannucci to adapt his British comedy, The Thick of It, into the series we now know as Veep, ABC attempted to adapt the show in 2007. That version of In the Thick of It starred John Michael Higgins and was overseen by Mitch Hurwitz and Richard Day. It was ultimately not picked up by the network, and at the time, Iannucci said it was terrible. It was, he said, it was all conventionally shot and there was no improvisation or swearing. And so thank God for HBO, because the improvisation and the swearing, executed by one of the greatest comedy ensembles of all time, is a big part of what made Veep one of the decade's most unique and essential shows. It chronicled the political ambitions of the selfish, ambitious, and outright venal Vice President Selina Meyer, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus. It's part political satire, part workplace comedy, part dysfunctional family comedy, part social commentary, and all brutally funny and unforgivingly brutal examination of humanity at its absolute worst. With 10 series regulars and a sprawling supporting cast, the ease with which Iannucci and later showrunner David Mandel and the cast balanced multiple overlapping storylines with a rapid-fire jokes per minute pace, you know, remains a miracle. There's just so much to praise about this show. Every character is at some point my favorite. So I'm just going to read my favorite line, which came from last season, which I think sums up so much of what makes Veep great. It comes from Selena's burned out campaign manager, Ben Cafferty, played by Kevin Dunn. He says, "Ma'am, you're going to be drowning in money so dark it could get shot entering its own apartment." Oh, like, God. It's everything in that joke is so, you know, it's political satire, it's social commentary, it's incredibly, like, brutal, but it's also so funny. And it really just, I don't even know where to start with Veep in terms of listing all the ways, all the reasons I love it. So I just wanted to just start talking to you about it, because it really is, you know, I talked earlier about, I like shows that are extreme, and this is extremely
I mean, this
brutal.
Is a show that started off like acidic and yes. just got like ever more, just viscously and viciously yes. like, dexterous in its portrayal of how terrible people in politics could be. And Kristen, this is a show that I also think it's kind of interesting because, you know, the way that it kind of evolved and grew over the mm-hmm. course of its time it has always really fascinated me because you had people like Gary Cole who kind of became more so central good. As it went along, or Sam Richardson as Richard Splatt, who I feel like that character kind of started off as, I don't want to say like a one-note joke, yeah. but a little bit more out there, and just the way that they kind of developed. The whole ensemble is pretty great. Kristen, this is a show that I loved a lot in its first four seasons, and then I kind of fell off on it. But it was interesting kind of talking about it so much with you this last season, because this last season was incredibly bleak.
Yes.
I mean, in some respects, like, bleaker than even something like your House of Cards is, or your kind of political right. melodramas, because it was just, what was going on was so horrifying, and the ever more ornate language the characters were perpetrating upon each other was just really kind of, I mean, the high wire act of this show and the way in which it portrayed its characters with such venom, and yet they were funny.
Yeah.
I find that to be a pretty incredible balancing act, especially thinking about Selina Meyer as a character is just so fascinating, because when the show started, I sort of feel like she was a little bit more of a, I don't want to say lovable, but there was something about it. Like, oh, you know, she's the Veep and the vice
right.
president's
she's
famously.
Put upon.
Right. She's very put upon. I mean, like, her development over the course of the show was really kind of remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, by the end, she is a ruthless killer. And, like, she, you know, the show itself, obviously, in terms of the real life world becoming as absurd in many ways as this show had been, it was, you know, difficult for the show to almost adapt. But they were able to do it in a way where, like, you know, this was a show that in its final season had a running joke about mass shootings. And like, it made perfect sense in that how did this campaign, it was one mass shooting after another, and she's on the campaign trail for president. How does she handle it? And the way that it was sort of commenting on our current news cycle and how we handle, you know, the news of a mass shooting, and then it gets, you know, it gets moved away by something else. There was an incredible sequence about a character getting an abortion, and which again was done. It made total sense for the story, but it was also, you know, tackled very head on in a way that, you know, few shows would dare to do. And then a lot of really silly stuff, you know, like Jonah, you know, played by Tim Simons, just the ongoing joy of coming up with new ways to insult him that you could see with, you know, the cast and the characters and the writers, like they just clearly loved it. And, you know, when a group like this is being elevated by each other in terms of, you know, improving and things like that, you can really tell everybody's at the top of their game. And so it's definitely a show that, like, it's not a feel-good show by any stretch of the imagination, but it never ceased to make me laugh.
Yeah, it's a feel able to laugh at things that are deeply
that
disturbing.
Are horrifying. Yes.
I mean, and even the way that, like, over the course of the show, the way that Selina Meyer, who was always so well defined that, like, I wouldn't say there's any one real world figure you could pick out and say that's her, but the way in which she kind of moved gradually from being a recognizably, you know, Hillary Clinton-esque figure within the political world of Veep, to ultimately being possibly more Trumpian than Trump was a truly interesting kind of overall journey for her. Veep is streaming on HBO and definitely will stand as a deeply disturbing reminder of a lot of the things that were going on in this decade.
Yes.
Kristen, we're sticking around on HBO for the next sitcom, and thinking about what you were saying earlier about these comedies that are extreme versus comedies that are kind of giving us, more than anything, one of the things I love about sitcoms is when you just kind of want to hang out with the people and you know, you feel as if you're kind of being welcomed into this world. For me, the best kind of hanging out with friends sitcom of the decade is Insecure on HBO, created by Issa Rae and Lair Wilmore. It stars Issa Rae as a character named Issa, who is very much on the tail end of her 20s going into her 30s, which is a time period that I'm generally interested in, especially since when the show started, that was what I was doing specifically. And what I love about the show is how season one kind of started off with her in what seemed like a kind of dead-end relationship with Lawrence, the character played by Jay Ellis. And more than anything, season one started off being about her friendship with her friend Molly, played by Yvonne Orji. But very quickly, you kind of got into this great sense that this was going to become more of an ensemble show. This may just be sort of my thing in general with TV that I like. The characters Kelly and Tiffany, played by Natasha Rothwell and Amanda Seals, kind of filled out central foursome of girlfriends. And more than anything, I just think this show captures in a really stylish and fun way a very specific kind of young 30-something existence. Some people kind of getting married, starting to have kids. Some people really trying to figure out what's going on with them. Issa kind of famously is constantly insecure with everything going on with her life, whereas Molly, when we first meet her, is a total, you know, lawyer, business badass who seems to have her life together in an exciting way, and what happens with them just feels very honest to those characters. You know, I love this past season had the Coachella episode, which I think will hopefully, you know, stand as the defining work on Coachella in the teens. And, you know, just in a really intangible way, Chris, it's just a show that I love being a part of. I just feel like, especially as it's gone along, it's gotten a lot more just kind of fashionable and stylish, and like the way that it kind of conjures up this very specific corner of Los Angeles is something that I really enjoy. And again, just thinking about the actors, Issa Rae, I think is, you know, she's a writer on the show, obviously, the co-creator, and just as a performer, I think is really, really fun. Jay Ellis has clearly become some kind of superstar for a lot of people, but he's incredibly charming, even if I'm not entirely sure how Lawrence fits into the show going forward. But I just think that, you know, for being the, I think every person kind of carries around in their heart, like, what's the Friends hanging out show that I want to hang out with? You know, for some people, it was Happy Endings. Apparently, for a lot of young people, it's Friends again, which is interesting. But that was kind of this show for me this decade, as far as just being like, you know, it was a great kind of gem in the HBO Sunday night. In some ways, less experimental than some other comedies, but really just as far as building this network of Friends on screen, it's something that I really kind of cherish. Is this a show that you've kind of dug into very much, Kristen?
No, I have seen several episodes and I always really enjoy it. And I appreciate that, like, that sense of, I love a show that, you know, again, we've talked again about these sort of auteurs, you know, people who clearly go in with a vision, and when the characters are so clearly created and delineated and they're formed from the beginning, which is something that I think, you know, if you look at sitcoms, and it's hard to call this a sitcom even, but if you look at half-hour comedies, traditionally, you know, you have stock characters, you know, the nosy neighbor and the sassy black friend and the whatever, you know, and the nagging wife and the whatever. But, like, over the last decade especially, the fact that, you know, networks and streamers were allowing people to try different ways, you know, because some of these episodes, you know, while there are funny moments, they're not necessarily,
it's painting in a lot of different emotional palettes, which I think is just great. I think that kind of deepens the sense of, like, there's no stock character on the show, which to me, that's what's kind of really exciting about getting to do sitcoms like this today, getting to watch them, is the feeling of, like, everyone is just so much more defined than they would be in the kind of blander ABC greenlights a remake version of this show.
And if, you know, and if they did, it would be like, frankly, it wouldn't feel, you know, because obviously it's important that it's also, you know, a black female creator and a predominantly black cast and, you know, presumably the writing staff as well is diverse. And, like, if you put it on ABC, you know, I think Black-ish does a really great job feeling like an actual authentic, you know, view of, you know, some African-American experience, whereas most of the time you can tell it's like, we are replicating the African-American experience with these actors and they are talking about being black. Whereas these shows like this, like Insecure, or, you know, we've talked before about, like, Rami or things, you know, they allow you to just experience what this person's perspective is without it being performative.
Yeah,
in a way.
Exactly right. Yeah, it doesn't feel like, because the thing you never want to feel with any show is that, and to me this is kind of the classic fear with any network sitcom, is a creator comes in with a totally distinct vision and background and everything, and then just the kind of clanking machinery of what broadcast would do to that would sort of result in this thing that you know, again, and you know, this is not critiquing anything specifically, just the sense of, like, a thing that nobody really wanted, that the creator would look at and say, like, you know, that's not really what I was going for.
Right.
And I just think that, you know, with a place like HBO, it's very clear that, like, they allowed this to kind of nurture and really, really become its own thing. And again, like, you know, it is somewhat, I think, in that niche of something like your Sex and the Cities or your Girls is, which became these incredibly kind of stylish and cool and for lack of a better word, hip looks at young people falling in and out of love in the big city. I mean, you know, that's kind of a tale as old as time in television. But for me, like, Insecure is kind of the one that just felt the most distinctive and fun. And again, I mean, that Coachella episode, I went to Coachella once in 2005 and never will go back. And I just felt like it was great to have such a kind of generational thing captured on screen. So I do hope that people will continue to check out Insecure. Season 4 is coming out next year, but the first 3 seasons are available however you watch your HBO.
So my next show is from Comedy Central, and Key and Peele won me over with 3 words, and those words were, I said, bitch. So the year was 2011, and Comedy Central had just sent me a screener DVD of their new sketch comedy show, Key and Peele. I almost tossed it on the ever-growing pile of screener DVDs on my desk and forgot about it, but the publicist for the show, who I liked and respected, called me and said, you know what, this one's really funny, I think you'd like it. So I watched it, and in one of the first sketches, two men, played by stars Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, complain about keeping their wives in line, hence the title of the sketch, I Said Bitch. But they only do it when they're sure their wives are out of earshot. And by the end of the sketch, the two dudes have gone all the way to outer space to make sure that their wives can't hear them complain about them. So, you know, former Mad TV stars Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele created a show that was endlessly, wonderfully silly, four words, East-West College Bowl, but also brilliantly, a brilliant exploration of broader themes of race, pop culture, and politics, but it never felt strident or pedantic. You know, while sketch shows are notoriously uneven, Key and Peele had a remarkably high laugh per episode ratio, and the episodes and sketches hold up years later. I mean, there are too many of my favorites to mention, and I went down a rabbit hole just, you know, looking to research this, but the tooth sketches that I think showcase Key and Peele's impeccable technical craft in terms of writing, timing, staging, physical comedy, and acting are, one, the valets, the two Liam Neeson-obsessed valets, and that is a wonderful work of physical comedy as well as just outright humor. And then there's a sketch simply called Othello. Two black guys attend the world premiere of Shakespeare's Othello. And, like, it's so intricately staged, and the amount of preparation and timing that would go into the way they deliver the dialogue to each other while being so incredibly funny is just incredible. But my favorite line, which I'm just going to read to you, is, if a brother killed himself every time he broke up with a white bitch, the world would be bereft of brothers. Which is, like, I mean, it's both very, very funny, but incredibly smart. And, like, it sums up everything that I love about the show. And I can go back and watch just any episode, and if I haven't seen it, I will find new things that I loved. Or if I've seen it 100 times, I mean, like, come on, Mr. Garvey, the substitute teacher, you know, who doesn't know how to say the white kids' names, you know, Aaron and stuff like that. Like, it's really is timeless, and I think it only ran for 5 seasons from 2012 to 2015. But the fact that they created so much comedy that is that holds up to this day is pretty impressive. And obviously, you know, Jordan Peele, you know, went on to become this Oscar-winning, you know, horror movie mastermind. And Keegan-Michael Key is somebody who, you know, everything he's in is funny, you know, and he keeps getting cast in things because he's just so incredibly charismatic. But, like, I really do. This is one of, you know, very few things on Comedy Central, you know, have stuck with me over the past decade, you know, but this is one that I really love.
Yeah, I mean, Kristen, you know, this show became such a sensation for so many reasons, and, like, you know, the way that they would just dig into this incredible reserve of social humor, of racial humor, of all this stuff, was always so talked about. But for me, the easiest thing to overlook about this show that I think about when I watch the sketches you mentioned, or one of my personal favorite sketches, the really elaborate spoof of Les Miserables, is it was just technically and stylistically and aesthetically so well done.
Yes.
You know, Dan Harmon, the creator of Community, would always talk about how with their kind of spoof episodes, he'd be, like, very meticulous about trying to literally recreate the look of a David Fincher movie or something. And you feel the same thing here with what Jordan Peele, who, I mean, if you were watching closely, no surprise he went on to become such an incredible film director. Because,
right.
You know, you see so much of that in the way that, you know, the worst thing that can happen with sketch comedy is when it just feels a little bit lazy on the filmmaking side.
Yeah.
And this never felt that way. I'm so glad to have you kind of calling this out, because, again, just to think about a show that would kind of create these events around itself. I mean, I remember just some weeks there'd be a new Key and Peele sketch that would just be making the rounds everywhere. And would just be, I mean, it's fascinating to think of this show kind of coming out in the Obama era, because in some ways it just feels as if, you know, the richness of it only becomes more and more clear as we move deeper and deeper into an era that is decidedly much more fraught.
Yes.
And it just feels as if this show really is kind of the gift that that keeps on giving. And even the idea of there being a good sketch show, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, Kristen, but when this debuted, I kind of feel like sketch as a genre on television, besides, you know, long lost memories of Chappelle's show.
Yes, exactly.
It seemed like kind of a dead genre, and I feel like this really kind of brought it back in such an incredible way.
Yeah, and you know, people often said, you know, compared it to the Chappelle show or to Chappelle's show, but honestly, like, you know, yes, it had black stars and often touched on race, but it was not, you know, I found this much more sillier in a but just as smart, if that makes any sense. And like, you know, the ways that they addressed race felt more unexpected. Not that Chappelle's show wasn't brilliant, but like the auction block sketch where the two slaves are upset that they're not getting bid on as one after the other, you know, as more slaves come up and get bid on, and they start getting upset and they try to pitch themselves to the, you know, like it's so, it is wrong, but it is not, but it's also very surprising and funny. And I just think that this is a show that had, you know, two very, people with very sort of accessible charisma and personalities doing some very you know, explosive and sort of sensitive comedy in a way that felt, you know, that everyone could enjoy, basically.
Yeah, they were just such an all-time great kind of comedy duo, too. Key & Peele is streaming now on Hulu.
Yes.
All kinds of things on Hulu, and hopefully that will continue to be the case, although we'll see where everything lands as shows continue to get siloed off and into their different corporate streaming services.
Also,
no one be
more about gel coat.
When the fourth round would.
Don't you call in the.
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with The Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist.
Kristen, we're going to cruise back in time just a little bit with my fourth pick as we're talking the best comedies of the 20-teens. And it seems only appropriate, Kristen, given what happened with comedy, that I have at least one pick that I know people will argue it's not a proper comedy.
Okay.
You know, this was very much the era of the half-hour show.
Right.
That, you know, I think comedy purists would complain was kind of painting more in the kind of dramatic, you know, emotional, if not downright sorrowful arena. And that's very true to a certain extent of Enlightened, the show created by Mike White and Laura Dern, which ran for two perfect seasons between 2011 and 2013. The show begins with Laura Dern as Amy Jellicoe, who is a hard-driving executive at a gigantic megacorporation literally called Abaddon Industries. Abaddon, of course, a name that is a reference to all kinds of nasty things. Google it. It's a bit of a nudge towards the symbolism you'll be experiencing here. But the show begins with her imploding into a nervous breakdown. And from there, it becomes a show that is broadly about somebody who, you know, is kind of in the early stages of middle age and is deciding that she wants to make the world a better place, wants to live a better life. And how will she do that? And what does that mean? It is still kind of a workplace comedy. She comes back to work and gets reduced to this kind of very mundane job, which is where she meets the other key star of the show, Mike White himself. Can't forget about Luke Wilson, who plays her ex-husband, or the great Diane Ladd, Laura Dern's actual mom, who plays Amy's mom on the show. They are living together. And Kristen, what this show does in a really short amount of time, two very short seasons, I think that the comparison point that comes to mind is something that people also probably will not get so much, but it's very pre-Lodge 49. It's a show about sort of life in the corporate world and life in the present day. And I even describe it sometimes as a workplace sitcom where you realize that the workplace is slowly destroying the world. Mm-hmm. And what do the people kind of do with that? But more than anything, it's just a great character show. Amy Jellicoe as a character and as a performance by Laura Dern is really remarkable because she's someone who, in a very annoying way, has kind of gone to this rehab facility, has come back with a new lease on life. Mm-hmm. And every episode, in some ways, it's kind of a countdown from her waking up in this sort of Southern California glow and saying, I am now a kind of new person. How will I make the world a better place? And just a constant downward spiral to the world, forcing her to become as, downtrodden and cynical as the rest of us are. Murderers row of incredible directors worked on this show: Nicole Hofstadter, Todd Haynes, Jonathan Demme, RIP, which kind of gives you a sense of the ways in which, especially in season two, the mood of the show and the style of it could just be so remarkable. There's an all-time great episode of television where Luke Wilson, who really, I think this show revived him for me as just an incredibly magnetic on-screen personality. But there's a whole episode about him going to rehab in Hawaii, and it's beautiful. It's a truly beautiful episode, just in terms of literally being there on the island and the journey it goes on. So is it a comedy? I would totally argue that yes, it's very much set in a heightened version of reality where you kind of have these characters, especially in season two, as it becomes about email hacking and whistleblowing. How did the show come out in 2013? It's so crazy.
I do wonder if it was just ahead of its time in terms of like all of these things. And certainly the idea of, slowly waking up to the realization that corporations can do massive amounts of harm, I think at the time it probably came across as, just too heightened in a way, whereas now we're realizing it's not that far-fetched.
Yeah, and I think also just at a time of, I don't necessarily recall 2011 as being incredibly optimistic, but the specific way that this show kind of approached its world and approached its characters, it feels as if, as you said, it was ahead of its time. I suspect at any time it would have probably been a short-lived critical gem. Yeah. I think it's incredible that we got the two seasons that we did. But Kristen, did you watch the whole run of?
I didn't, and it's definitely one where I think I should go back and watch now, because I remember watching it at the time and it being just feeling, making me like finding it unpleasant, and not like I don't like this because it's, it's crappy, but more like this is a hard viewing experience, you know, and it is. And I think at the time that was not something we were used to so much in and it's not so much that it's, the like cringe comedy of like the original Office or things like that, but like it's a challenging
Absolutely challenging. And in a way that's kind of interesting to think of, because Dern, who, has obviously had just so many moments recently of really, really in a wonderful way coming back into the public eye. Amy as a kind of difficult protagonist, it's kind of doubly difficult because on one hand, there are these aspects of her that are kind of downright unlikable. And yet also she's very strident about wanting to be a better person, which in its own way is equally kind of unlikable.
Yes.
We're so used to these characters where what's fun about them is that they're cynical or that they're, and that's kind of not her, or at least that's not how she presents. And so I just think that the way that the show really brings you around to loving her for all of her faults is just really kind of remarkable. I hope people do continue to rediscover it. It's on HBO. It's 2 seasons, 18 episodes, real fast watch.
Real
fast binge.
And, you know, if ever it was a time that it could get rediscovered, you know, now is it, in terms of, like, it's just there sitting on your HBO queue and, you know, easy to, and you love Laura Dern, so, like.
And you know what? Everybody learned to love Luke Wilson again. He's great.
Although, like, now isn't he doing, like, toothpaste commercials? And it's kind of dumb.
Well, you know what, Kristen? I'm sure they pay very well.
Yeah, you know what? Guys gotta eat. I get it, but, like.
I'm sure the makers of Crest or whatever are big fans of Enlightened and are very aware of the irony of hiring someone from Enlightened to star in their corporate advertisement.
You know, like, whatever it takes. I shouldn't job shame. I feel like... You know, I just feel like it's a little bit like, oh, that guy used to be a romantic comedy lead. And, you know, maybe he will be again, but good for him. I mean, we may as well keep going with the 2-season critical gem from HBO. You've heard me rave about my next show before, Darren. I've already celebrated HBO's The Comeback in our episode about best series finales.
Woohoo!
And today I'm going to add it to my list of the best comedies of the last decade. Season 1, which aired in 2005, is about Valerie Cherish, a former sitcom star played by Lisa Kudrow, who is attempting to revive her career by playing Aunt Sassy in a tacky new sitcom called Room and Board. Meanwhile, she's being followed by a reality TV camera crew for a show called The Comeback, which is going to chronicle her comeback. As Lisa Kudrow explained to EW in 2005, quote, it's a show within a show about a woman who was on another show. So in season 2, which, you know, came many years later, it premiered in 2014 on HBO, it explores what happens when Valerie gets what she wants, which is fame, stardom, and a modicum of respect. And it begins with Valerie learning that Pauly G, the writer who created Room and Board and tormented her mercilessly, has now created a meta-comedy for HBO about the making of Room and Board. And this new show, a dark comedy called Seeing Red, features a character called Mallory Church, who is very clearly based on Valerie. And there's this devastating scene in the season 2 premiere when Valerie goes in to yell at HBO and Pauly, who's played by Lance Barber, for doing this show without her permission. And so in an effort to defuse the situation, they tell her, oh, you know, how about you audition for Mallory right now? And Pauly gives her this tough, dramatic monologue to read on the spot. And this moment is just so incredible, and it just encapsulates what's so good about the second season of the show. Valerie takes a moment to read the monologue, and you can see just from her face, you know, that she's unhappy with what she sees on the page. But then she channels that displeasure into this incredible rage-fueled performance of this monologue, which says in part, and again, in this monologue, she's Valerie Cherish reading Mallory Church, who is clearly her. And it's based on what clearly happened in the experience of Room and Board. She says, you think I'm this dried up middle-aged woman? Look at the jokes you write. Look at the tracksuits you make me wear. All saying the same thing. I'm old. I'm annoying. I'm unfuckable. Well, I'm not the joke, okay? You are. And it's like, it goes on to just, she just eviscerates him. And meanwhile, like, it's incredibly surreal, you know, for them to watch Valerie read a character that's clearly based on her and vent all this anger that she clearly has. And of course, she gets the part, and the rest of the season is about her making this show. But what it's also about is her almost finding kind of, it goes a much more personal route in that it starts to take a toll on her marriage to her husband, Mark, and she ultimately has to make a choice between, you know, what she thought she always wanted and what she already had. And, you know, so not only was The Comeback, you know, sometimes incredibly painful and hilarious and, you know, really great satire of reality TV, it also pulled off the impressive and rare trick of making a second season that was deeper, richer, and even better than the first. And I know you haven't watched, Darren. I know it's on your Sunday list, but, you know, look, you and I can both do sort of a simultaneous two-season HBO binge. I'll get through Enlightenment, you know, and yes. Enlightened, and you watch The Comeback. But it's just, yeah.
It's just embarrassing that I haven't seen it, truly.
There's
because,
just too much,
I mean,
though.
On top of everything else, just the sort of reality framework mm-hmm. of it is something that I know would totally appeal to me. But as I said in the finale episode, Kristen, it's just, you know, everything you're saying sounds great. I feel ashamed for not seeing it. You've successfully watch shamed me with regards
not,
to
not
the comeback.
Not on purpose.
but I do hope that, like me, everybody will check it out. It is on HBO Go, HBO Now, soon to be on HBO Max. What other HBOs are there?
I mean, HBO OBH? I don't know. We'll
HBO 8, The Ocho? Kristen, my last show is a show that, in some respects, the least well-known of the shows that I'm going to talk about today, except for any of our listeners in the UK, where it may, in fact, be quite well-known. Mm. I'm talking about the Trip series of shows, the trip to Italy and the trip to Spain. These are shows that star Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon as fictionalized versions of themselves, going to very nice restaurants and very nice hotels, first in the UK and then on the continent, and talking to each other. Who are Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, you are probably wondering? Well, Steve Coogan is the comedian from Britain who is very famous for not being as famous in America as he is in Britain. In the UK, he's considered quite justifiably a true icon mm-hmm. for creating some all-time TV shows like his various Alan Partridge series. Rob Brydon, definitely not as well-known here in America, well-known in the UK as a comedian. And just this show, Kristen, the dynamic that they create on screen, for me, it's the kind of duo of the decade as far as just being... you know, it's so funny and so sharp. Steve Coogan kind of plays himself as the kind of slightly more egomaniacal, you know, more famous of the two. And
right.
yet so much of, especially the first trip when they're going around the North Country, is kind of constantly about how people seem to like Rob Brydon so much more. Like in the kind of like context of UK fame, he's the kind of relatable every guy.
Right, right.
And Steve Coogan at that point, his character is kind of meant to be living abroad. What this show is kind of known for, Kristen, if it's known at all, is that what they're doing throughout in each episode is constant impressions. You know, their impression of Michael Caine kind of went viral. There are some incredible back and forths of them doing James Bond, incredible back and forths of them doing Pacino. And, you know, boy, Kristen, bad improv is something that makes me feel physically ill. And this is some of the greatest improv and greatest riffing of all time. You know, in a strange way, The Trip and its sequels is kind of a sketch show in the sense that each episode you kind of will have these sequences of them kind of sitting down and just as they're talking and the way they launch into these riffs. It has the kind of flow of something that is sort of easily digestible. There's a reason why the Michael Caine thing kind of became a standalone video on its own. But in a broader sense, the Trip series, and I should clarify that in the UK, this has aired as kind of three miniseries. It was released in a kind of edited down feature film version here in the States. I would highly recommend seeking out the original series version of this, which you can do through some legal means, I'm sure. but what I also just love, Kristen, and the reason why, especially the Trip to Italy, the kind of second season of the Trip, why it stands out to me is that just as a really lovely and funny and sharp portrait of friendship, of male friendship, of guys who are kind of cusping on the edge of middle mm-hmm. age, who I believe both performers turned 50 over the course of filming the second or third one. It feels really kind of lovely to me. You know, they're very much like the sort of friends that are kind of constantly jockeying against each other, and you know, their closeness is sort of as definable as the ways in which they don't seem to like each other.
Yes.
And I just think that, you know, the way that Bryden and Coogan create that feeling on screen, you know, it feels, it's oddly personal, even as it is really just kind of a constant laugh riot. And,
right.
you know, there's so many sequences of Trip to Italy where it's just the two guys kind of driving around Italy listening to Alanis Morissette. And that's pretty perfect, I think.
Well, yeah.
Have you kind of fallen down the rabbit hole of this show beyond the kind of Michael Caine stuff?
Which No, I haven't.
What kind of made it live for a lot of people?
I haven't, and it sounds like something I would totally enjoy because, you know, like you said, there's really, is there anything better than watching brilliant comedians, you know, riff? There just isn't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
in the context of something like this, where, you know, we've talked a lot about shows that just feel like experiences as opposed to just, you know, things that you watch passively, you know, this sounds like a wonderful combination of just like great comedy, beautiful scenery, and
the food
porn, right. So yes, it is something that I must add to my someday list, because yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I love watching, you know, one of the things I loved about Veep is just watching these people who are so good at improvising and playing off each other, you know, do it in a way, you know, obviously it's very opposite from this show in that this show sounds like it has a lot of heart, whereas Veep is totally heartless, but you know, it can be a real joy to watch people
and
do this.
I think it's a brilliant comparison also, Kristen, because Armando Iannucci and Steve Coogan were kind of long ago collaborators,
yeah.
and there's just a similar germ of like the tightly controlled improv, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, nothing worse than bad improv,
worse.
nothing better than like truly great improv. So I do hope that everyone does check out The Trip, the first season. You can buy it on Amazon Prime.
Mm-hmm.
The second and third seasons, Italy and Spain, only available in the feature film version, but you can probably find them somewhere. I don't know. You know what? Go to the UK,
yeah.
stay in an Airbnb, rent the DVDs, yeah. and watch them.
And
that's
what
I would recommend to everyone. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
All right. Well, so for my last show, I'm going to go with something probably the most traditional sort of sweet show on my list. It's Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which aired from 2013 to 2018 on Fox and 2019 to the present on NBC. And, you know, this is a show, there's so much that I love about it, including Andre Brouwer. I don't know how he has not won an Emmy for his performance as Captain Holt. But what I love about the show the most, and what makes it feel more necessary than ever, is that every episode is, at its core, about people helping each other. Season one did pit Andy Samberg's goofball cop Jake Peralta against his stickler for the rules new boss, Captain Holt. But Brooklyn Nine-Nine, much like Parks and Recreation before it, went from good to great when the central characters left their sitcom squabbling behind and became friends. It should be noted that Brooklyn was created by Dan Gore and Parks and Rec co-creator Michael Schur. So, you know, the best workplace comedies from The Mary Tyler Moore Show on are about the second families that we form in the 9-to-5 trenches, and the cops in Brooklyn's precinct love hate each other in the way that only relatives can. And as it should be in a family, everyone, no matter how annoying they are, has something to contribute. You know, even Brooklyn's sedentary office buffoons Hitchcock, played by Dirk Blocker, and Scully, played by Joel McKinnon Miller, have earned the precinct's grudging respect with their unexpected abilities when they use their finely honed dessert deduction skills to locate Holt's missing pie. You know, rather than choosing specific episodes to tackle topics like racism or homophobia or sexism, from day one, Brooklyn created a universe that was diverse and progressive and wholly inclusive without ever being preachy. And I guess the thing I love the most about Brooklyn Nine-Nine is how the show rewards the loyalty of its fans. It creates a cumulative effect of humor through long-running gags, like title of your sex tape, yearly traditions, like the Halloween heist, and ever-deepening character backstories. Of course, last season we saw the very unexpected backstory of Hitchcock and Scully, which involved hot wings. You know, and I dare say that no show in the history of TV will ever find a better use for the Backstreet Boys song I Want It That Way. This is a show that I just, you know, it makes me happy. It's a show that always makes me laugh. It's something that I'm you know, there was such an outcry when it was canceled for about 4 days, you know, because people love it. It is a show that is just really kind-hearted and silly, but generally about, you know, it's a sort of utopia of what, you know, the idea of that this police precinct that is, you know, no doubt home to a lot of really unsavory things is a place where people really love and support and, you know, lift each other up. And that's, you know, it may sound corny, but it's something that I think Mike Schur and Dan Gore do really well, which is creating these, you know, these sort of corny, loving situations for their characters while also making them, you know, weird and funny and unexpected.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to me, Kristen. This is a show that, like, I've watched way, way less than you. But one thing I always kind of like about it when I do tune in is kind of that quality you're talking about. And it's not corny, but it does feel to me like it's maybe the primal sitcom experience, mm-hmm. which is so hard to create. But kind of having people on screen who do genuinely have that kind of chemistry, the kind of workplace family, genuine friendship. Chemistry, which, you know, in our time of experimental, artistic, what have you on television, in some ways, that's still kind of the hardest thing to create.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you were just saying about it reminded me, Kristen, of a show that I'm not talking about today, which I'll be talking about separately in our 20 teens coverage, is BoJack Horseman. Because I just think that animation, we'll save that for another time, and everyone knows how much I love animation because I cry about it all the time. But there's a great episode of BoJack Horseman where the main character was on a show in the 90s, and he kind of talks about this idea of, you know, 90s sitcoms could seem so goofy, and, you know, for a while there had kind of a bad reputation, but there was something kind of brilliant about them and wonderful about them and the world that they could create. And to me, you know, seeing the kind of love that this show creates, I do think about that a lot. And boy, I mean, what a cast of people to assemble all in one place, too. Because even like, you know, when the show started, I think some people were kind of less well known. But like Andre Brower in a comedy like this, it's just brilliant.
Like, yeah, and like Terry Crews, I love as this, you know, he's a jacked guy, but he's this very sensitive, loving father whose daughters are named Cagney and Lacey, you know, like, which is absurd, but it's, and Terry loves yogurt. And then, you know, Amy Santiago, played by Melissa Fumero, is, you know, she is somebody who could have just been the sort of like stickler, you know, prim, whatever, but she ends up getting to have, you know, yes, she loves rules and she has her binders and she organizes things, but she's also like really good at her job and Jake loves her, you know, and that romance between Jake and Amy didn't destroy the show. You know, that's that's important because they know the writers are very good about balancing, you know, the storylines of the other characters. I mean, Charles Boyle, Joe Latruglio, and his, you know, inadvertent double entendres and, you know, son that he adopted from what, Croatia, Nikolaj, who I'm probably saying that name wrong, you know, like that's this ongoing source of just random and very funny humor. And of course, you know, Stephanie Beatriz as Rosa is one of my favorite characters. And if you go back and watch her from season one, when her voice was totally different, they allowed her to like develop that character over time. And it really is a testament to, you know, what a great comedic actress she is. So just, you know, it's one of those shows where it's like, it is very traditional in a lot of ways. And I am, you know, there are very few broadcast comedies that I really feel attached to, and this is one of them.
Yeah, you know, for me, Kristen, the show that's on NBC right now that does that for me is Superstore. And I'm realizing that it's interesting, maybe this is kind of like an incredible new development of this decade specifically, but the sitcom Will They or Won't They, that miraculously does not destroy the show, ultimately.
Yeah.
Because on Superstore, there was a Will They, Won't They, and now they're happily together, and it's fine.
And it's fine.
Fun. And even kind of, I think, you know, opening up new comedic possibilities for the show. And I feel as if certainly Parks and Rec was an example of that, too, where everyone kind of wound up happily coupled up. And it only kind of, you know, extended the show's life as it kind of, you know, evolved itself. But that's interesting that this is kind of another example of that, of kind of letting the characters live and breathe. And it doesn't get to a point where you're like, oh, no, this change they've done has kind of drastically altered the show in some way.
Yeah.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine returning to NBC in the new year and currently streaming on Hulu.
Basically, everything's on Hulu.
It's all on Hulu and it's on HBO. And so that's all you need besides CBS All Access, which I know we'll be talking about next week.
Yes.
When we talk about the best dramas of the decade. Kristen, that wraps it up for this week's episode of Best of Shows. What great fun we've had going down through the best comedies of the 20-teens. Be sure to let us know what you thought about comedy this decade. The ones we talked about are the ones we missed. I'm on Twitter at Darren Franich. Kristen's on Twitter at Kristen G. Baldwin. Love hearing from everybody. Be sure to give us a rating or a review wherever you find your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and radio.com. We'll be back the same time next week chatting about the best dramas of the 20-teens. I should have a catchphrase, but I don't. So, goodbye.